You are listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 21st of February, 2016, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, author, and professor. Over the past 30 years, Joseph Stiglitz has been at the forefront of the global economy's biggest debates, both on the inside and the outside of the establishment. He was a key economic advisor to President Bill Clinton, then chief economist of the World Bank, but in the past two decades, he's been a fierce critic of globalization. I'm pleased to say that he joins me now. Joseph Stiglitz, welcome. You can be described as an economist, a political advisor, an author, an activist even. How would you describe your job and what you do?
That's a great question. I guess I self-identify more with being a professor more than anything else. And I always think of everything as coming out of, you might say, my intellectual roots. But the perspective as a public intellectual and as an activist are in some ways very much related to that intellectual foundation, because the reason I went into economics was that I was very concerned about these social, economic problems, inequality, discrimination, unemployment. I had begun my studies at Amherst College as a physics student, and I love the physics and I love the mathematics, but these other social problems, economic problems kept bothering me. And at the beginning of my third year of college, I said, as much as I like physics, I really had to devote my life to economics.
And for a large part of your life, that was in universities and in the academic world. What was it that made you think you needed to branch out from there?
As I said, I always had this view that I wanted to do something about poverty and inequality and discrimination. So that was what drove me all the time. But there was also, even in my getting involved in government, a sort of an intellectual aspect of it. Having written for a number of years about the economics of the public sector, what government should do, I felt I wanted to get inside the beast. I wanted to see what it was really like. And
what was it like being inside the beast?
Well, it was in many ways very different from what I had expected. Being in a hierarchical large organization is very different from being in academia. You know, when you're a college professor, there really is no boss. We always viewed the dean, the president, working for us. When you go and work in the White House, it's very clear who the boss is. The president is the top guy. I was a little bit surprised, coming from academia, the extent to which he was given deference. You know, we live in a world where, as academics, where you evaluate each idea on its own merit with who says it having relatively little weight. But when the president says something, everybody pays attention. And I also found it very interesting, the jockeying to be with the president, sort of the sociology of the White House.
And did you try to do that yourself? Did you find yourself falling into that?
I don't think so very much. I mean, you can't help but do it a little bit. But I did become very interested in, you might call, the art and science of how do you have influence with the president? Where do you sit if the president and his cabinet are sitting around the table, where you're more likely to catch his eye?
So you worked out where the best seat was. Well,
yeah, I did think about that. And so,
and what is the best seat?
Well, you want to be across. You don't want to be, you know, people like to be right next to him. But of course, he doesn't turn his eyes all the way to the left or all the way to the right that much. And so you're more likely to catch his eye if you're sitting across. But it's also trying to think about how do you get your ideas into a large and complex bureaucracy. And I think we had some degree of success. And it was partly because we were, when I say we, I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, we were much less hierarchical than other parts of the government. So I would make an effort not only to talk to what we, in England would be called the cabinet ministers, to the secretaries, but also to the deputy secretaries who are often in charge of the policymaking, but also to their staff, to the economists who were advising them. So we knew we had to operate both at a political level and at the level of ideas.
When the Clinton administration ended, the start of the new century, that period was then sort of looked back on as, well, this was a wonderful period of prosperity and growth. Looking at the 90s now, though, the picture isn't necessarily as rosy, is it?
No, and I was very concerned. I actually left the administration in 1997. And, you know, to be fair, life had become very difficult because both houses of Congress were controlled by the opposite party. And that meant getting legislation through was extraordinarily difficult. But I was very concerned about some of the policies that were being pushed. While I was there, I was able to stop them. I think there were other forces stopping them. For instance, there was an effort to deregulate the financial sector, what was called the repeal of Glass-Steagall. I strongly opposed it, and it didn't happen until after I left. There were other things that I strongly opposed, lowering the taxes on capital gains, which probably did as much to increase inequality at the top as anything else. I strongly opposed that, but that was something where the president and some people in Treasury, and our secretary in our Treasury, thought was an area that they could make a compromise with the Republicans, but, you know, sort of was a bargain with the devil. Yes, you could get something through, but was it something that would make our economy perform better? And the answer to me was unambiguously no.
When you look at the state of the presidential campaign right now, particularly on the Democratic side, from both Bernie Sanders and indeed Hillary Clinton, there is something of a repudiation of the economics of the 1990s, isn't there?
Very much so. I find it very heartening, to be honest. I think some of the ideas, what we would call progressive ideas of trying to make our society more inclusive, recognizing that there are large groups within our society that have been excluded, trying to reduce inequality, realizing that these kinds of things have actually undermined our economy, divided our society, weakened our democracy, that there were other things like the deregulation of the financial sector distorted our economy. There were things, other actions that led to an increase in short-termism. So all of this are the things that I was actually working for when I was there. And I have to say, I find it very heartening that they finally have risen to the top of the agenda.
Hearing you talking there, your views sound more similar, I think it's fair to say, to Bernie Sanders than to perhaps Hillary Clinton. But I notice you're not wearing a Feel the Burn sticker. Why not? Why aren't you supporting Bernie Sanders wholeheartedly?
Well, what I'm trying to promote is what you might call progressive agenda. And to me, the most important thing is that this country adopts that kind of an agenda. I mean, I think it's really important for our future. I mean, for the last third of a century, the United States began this experiment. You might call it was supply-side economics, Reaganomics, a little bit like Thatcherism. It hasn't worked. The bottom 90% has basically seen their income stagnate, whatever has happened to GDP. So we have to change course. And to me, that's the most important thing. So I've been trying to influence both of the candidates to adopt this progressive agenda and a workable progressive agenda.
Ah, now that word then, workable. So essentially you're looking for someone who's also a bit pragmatic, who can understand that you can't just click your fingers and change the world.
Very much so. You know, when you hear some of the ideas, say, from Trump, occasionally he says something reasonable, like there's a detail in our tax code. We have this peculiar provision where some people doing private equity pay lower taxes than a plumber or somebody working for a living. And he's argued that you ought to get rid of that. And that's fine. But you listen to him, and he sort of has this view, you snap your fingers and you solve the problem. Both Bernie and Hillary, I think, realize that things are much more difficult. And so what I've been trying to do is to help people understand, how do we get into this fix? And how can we get practical, workable solutions to solve these problems? And let me say, I know that it's not going to happen overnight, but I feel so invigorated by the fact that some of the things I talked about 20 years ago are now on the agenda.
After you left the Clinton White House, you ended up at the World Bank as its chief economist. And this was at a time when the World Bank was doing what a lot of people in the developing world saw as really quite controversial and rather damaging things to their economies. Did you go in with your eyes open, seeing this as a battle to take on to try and change the World Bank's view? Or did you always sort of know that that might be a bit of a mission impossible?
No, I went in very much with a view of trying to change what was going on. To be honest, I did not realize how bad things were. I'll be frank. And one of the things that I found very striking was that many of the ideas that there was a broad consensus within the Clinton administration, which I didn't think was a very left wing, but you might say a mildly progressive, the World Bank was pushing just the opposite. So we were, in the Clinton administration, defending public retirement insurance, Social Security, as we called it. We thought we had done an analysis, and we showed that it was an efficient way of delivering. And yet the World Bank was pushing privatization. I found that astounding. And what I found even more astounding is quite often it was the U.S. Treasury was pushing things that were the opposite of what even the President Clinton would have supported if he knew about what was going on. And that was where I got some further insights into, you might say, the complexity of politics. And at the global level, they're even more complex. So very soon after going to the World Bank, I began my work trying to conceptualize what was wrong with what they were doing. Because I thought, you know, you can't kill an idea without an alternative idea. And I thought if I could articulate the wrong assumptions underlying what the World Bank had been doing, if I could explain, show as chief economist that many of those policies were not working and that there were alternatives that would actually promote growth and promote inclusive growth, I felt that there was some chance that I would win. And I was lucky. I had a receptive president. Jim Wolfensohn was the president at the time. The executive director of the World Bank from the United States was very supportive. So you might say the stars became aligned, and that began a three-year battle to change not just the World Bank, but I have to say, try to change the IMF. And we didn't do it all in 3 years, but things did change.
Do you really think that things have changed in that sense? Do you think that the sort of the prevailing way of doing things in terms of the global economy over the last 20, 30 years has actually really changed?
The prevailing ideas have changed unambiguously. You know, you have the IMF, which was much more to the right of the World Bank in those days, talking about how inequality is bad for economic performance. You have the IMF explaining in Europe how austerity is bad for economic performance.
Well, you've had parts of the IMF saying that.
Research department.
Yes, you've had the research department saying that, but the political leadership of the IMF took a very, very long time to say that.
It took them a very long time. These are long-term battles. But let me just give you one concrete policy idea where they officially changed their position. I had taken the view that these short-term speculative capital flows where money can rush into a country and then rush out were more likely to destabilize an economy and hurt economic growth than to promote economic growth. And that was viewed as extraordinarily controversial. People made all kinds of accusations. The IMF, in the last few years, has adopted that view as their official view. So these are large organizations, and when it has come to some aspects of the European program, the Troika, there's been a great deal of disappointment. But within that Troika, and within the European Central Bank, the EC, and the IMF, on many of these issues, the IMF has been the better part of these three in trying to limit the damage of austerity and even in terms of encouraging, realizing the need for debt restructuring.
Have your views changed much over the past 30 years?
Oh, obviously, in many ways, they have changed. I think I've come to feel even more strongly that inequality is an economic problem. I think I've gotten a lot better understanding of the sources of inequality, which I articulate in my last book called Rewriting the Rules, and argue that it has to do not just with economic forces, but with political, the policies that are adopted. So I suppose I've gravitated from what would have been a more conventional economist, I wouldn't say ever fully conventional, to approaching these issues from a much broader perspective with a more understanding both of the sociological and the political aspects of the form and the impacts that those have on the economy and economic performance.
This is a hard question for anyone to answer, but how influential do you think you personally can actually be? Because when we look at, you know, when you're in the Clinton White House, you're saying, well, look, I managed to do this, but then I left and then they did it anyway. And I tried to change the World Bank and, okay, then I had to quit. And 30 years later, it sort of changed, but it's taken a while. You know, you're advising politicians all over the world. Do you feel that you're actually able to advise the ones that are actually able to make a difference?
Sometimes. I think these kinds of discussions do make a difference. I also believe very strongly in democracy, and part of believing in democracy is that no single individual should have the weight of determining where our societies go. I view myself very much, both in my public writing, in my advocacy, as part of a democratic political process where I hope the weight of the argument influences others, and that sort of, you might say, democratic movement is what eventually, gradually, brings about the changes that I think our societies need.
I mentioned the people that you're advising. One of those at the moment is the new leadership of the Labour Party in the UK. What is it that you're doing with them?
Well, what I'm trying to do is very much the same kind of thing that I'm trying to do with the Democratic candidates in the United States. My main concern is the adoption of what might be called a progressive economic agenda. I felt that if this kind of progressive economic agenda is adopted on both sides of the Atlantic, it will give it more force. I mean, that, or it becomes discussed on both sides. If the social democratic parties in Europe, the labor parties in Europe, come to views that are similar to the progressive movement in the United States, they will reinforce each other, and also in Asia.
Mm. But what's that meant in practice in terms of your support for the Labour Party leadership?
Oh, like in many cases, it's more discussion. It's trying to talk about ideas. I will be, you know, trying to advance the kinds of ideas that I've articulated in this book we called, in that case, Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy. But more broadly, within Europe, we are engaged in an exercise you might call rewriting the rules of the European economy to try to see what are the rules of the economy that have led to this enormous increase in inequality in most countries. How is it that a few countries have avoided that? And, you know, what are the policies that have led to this remarkable slowdown in economic growth and growth in productivity. You know, these are remarkable changes that have happened in our societies in the last 30 years. And I don't think people have fully understood the role that policies have played in this really dismal economic performance.
And so just to stick on the UK for a moment, because you've advised Ed Miliband, the previous Labour leader beforehand, what do you make so far of Jeremy Corbyn in the conversations you've had with him so far?
Well, I haven't had a chance actually to have any conversations with him. I hope to my next couple of trips to London to begin an engagement on these progressive issues. As I say, I think the issues on which I will be focused are the economic and you might say the social issues, because as I said before, those two interact very, very strongly. And it's an agenda that will recognize that it's not just the bottom that has been suffering, it's the bottom 90%. Some people will say the bottom 99%. And when you have an economy that is not working for the bottom 90% or the bottom 99%, something is fundamentally wrong with that economy. I think we are in the process of trying to understand how we've created an economy that works for the 1% but not for the rest. And I think what we have to do, as I try to articulate in this other book called Rewriting the Rules, how can we write the rules again, change the policies in ways that will advance the interest of the vast majority of our citizens on both sides of the Atlantic?
Do you feel that globalization in some ways has a bad reputation? Because when you look over the whole course of history, we're richer now than we've ever been before. There are fewer people in poverty than ever before. And that surely is down to capitalism and globalization.
I would say that the reason for the success of the global economy over the last 200 years actually dates back to the Enlightenment, to science, to the advances in technology. Now, unambiguously, globalization has transformed the world in the last 30 years. 400 or 500 million people in China have moved out of poverty. Probably one of the most important, you might say, economic events in history. Globalization played a very important role in that. So yes, I think the benefits of globalization have been underappreciated. At the same time, because globalization has often not been well managed, it's been managed more in the interests of, say, global finance than in the interest of ordinary individuals, there is a good justification for the bad reputation that globalization has had. You know, just think about the trade agreement that's now being discussed, TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the United States, and a little bit the TPP, the TTIP, the similar agreement across the Atlantic. If you look at the gizzards of that agreement, what we say inside that agreement, the most important provisions are an investment agreement. And those investment provisions in the investment agreement, as they were formulated in secret by the USTR with the corporations, are designed to be a massive power and profit grab by our corporations. They are basically designed to make it very difficult to regulate for health, safety, the environment, or even the economy. So to me, TPP is a wonderful example of globalization gone awry.
Are there times where you feel frustrated and you feel that, you know, you're not being listened to?
Oh, a lot of the time. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people who don't listen to me. A lot of people who disagree with me. But there are also a lot of people who agree with me. So, you know, that's part of our pluralistic society, that there is disagreement. And to me, one of the important things is that we keep an openness in our society so that there is this flow of ideas. One of the things that's concerned me is in the last 10, 15 years, I've worried about, you might say, the compartmentalization of our society, where I have my friends and those who agree with me, and they listen to me, and they like what I write, and that makes me happy. But what does frustrate me is that many on the other side have closed down their minds and are basically listening just to each other. And the result of that is it's hard to penetrate, hard to change, hard to get consensus in our society.
That's not just on the other side, though, is it? There are, and if you don't mind me bracketing you as on the centre-left, there are people on the centre-left, and indeed the left, who have exactly that same problem of compartmentalisation, of not listening to other views.
Almost surely, yes. I mean, but this goes back to my own beginnings as an academic. I began, you know, with a quest of ideas to try to understand why our society seemed so different from what the mythical ideal we were told, you know, a land of opportunity. Everybody was treated fairly. And when I was growing up, I saw discrimination, inequality, lots of unemployment. It wasn't that golden age, that perfection that when I read the textbooks, America was supposed to be. So part of the quest for ideas is to try to understand what are the ideas on the other side? And quite frankly, what's wrong with those ideas? I mean, I've seen how some of those ideas have led to greater inequality. And it's to me, if I'm going to win the argument, I have to be able to understand what they're saying and analyze it.
You've been on both the inside of organizations and the outside. Where do you feel you've had most influence?
I think that's a really hard question. I've actually thought about that a lot. I think as a textbook writer, there's a lot of impact. I think some of the purely theoretical academic ideas have had a big impact. The notion that I got the Nobel Prize for, that markets are imperfect, partly because of asymmetries of information. Idea that sort of people understood, but the theory that had been developed over 200 years ignored it. And bringing that in was, I think, very influential. The public writings, started writing Globalization Inc.'s Discontents, The Price of Inequality, a number of books aimed at a broader audience, enabled me to reach out and talk to people who I hadn't talked to, either as academics or as students. And finally, being an insider and an activist, seeing things from both perspectives at the same time, I think has had a role. So to me, you might say the diversified portfolio approach is something consistent with my own views about how one should manage one's portfolio.
Well, to give you a final question then on this issue of influence, let's look ahead 12 months and imagine that either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton has been elected president of the United States, and they call you up and they say, right, which job do you want in my administration?
I think the kind of role I'd like to play is as a close advisor, but outside the administration.
So you wouldn't take an administration job now?
You know, when the president asks you to do something and makes a compelling case, you can't say no. But if there were an open discussion, I would say, I think for me, the ability even to criticize what you are doing publicly is important. My credibility partly depends on my independence. But on the other hand, I would very much like you to listen to me, and sometimes for me to be able to give you advice that I might not want to broadcast on TV and radio. So for me, the ideal position would be as a close advisor, but continuing my teaching, writing at the university, and writing some more popular books that might have some impact on general perceptions.
So half in, half out.
Exactly. But that may not be a choice that I have.
Joseph Stiglitz, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Steve Bloomfield, in conversation with Joseph Stiglitz. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lucy, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Nina Narek. My thanks also to Joseph Colmenero and Anthony Spinato here at the Cutting Room Studios in New York. Don't forget to subscribe to this and indeed any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or of course, monocle.com. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. you.